Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Kiwi Talks. My guest today, you could say he's a jack of all trades, but that would be putting it lightly. This guy has a sheer amount of talent. He's a director, a producer. He's done numerous voice acting gigs, whether it's over audiobooks or radio or documentaries. The list goes on. And he's also done voice work for video games such as Castlevania and Metroid Dread. I'd like to welcome the great Stephen Hughes. How's it going?
Well, thank you very much. It's quite a pleasure to be here and an honor. So thank you very much.
Been a long time coming. It has.
Yes, it has. Between one thing and another, it's been a while before we could finally connect up.
Yeah.
Here we are.
Here we are. So the question I want to start with is, how did you end up in Spain? You're a man from America, you know?
Right.
And right. You ended up in Madrid, Spain. So how did that happen?
Well, people tend to assume it's either because I grew up in Miami, where, you know, we hear and speak a lot of Spanish, or because somewhere in my past I have, you know, some Spanish family. And the truth is, neither of those had anything to do with it. I spoke some Spanish because growing up in Miami, of course, that was about the time when people started transitioning from studying French to studying Spanish because it was more practical and so on. And I studied Spanish, of course. But it wasn't that. And I didn't speak, you know, until I got here, I didn't really speak anywhere near as well as I do now. No, it was more, I was in college and working hard and so on. And frankly, I was just kind of burned out. I went to a very demanding prep school and I went to a very demanding college. And I probably should have taken a gap year off or something. But I didn't want to take a gap year off unless I was going to do something, had a project. And I didn't have a project.
Right.
So just to take a year off and goof around, well, no. So I finished university, but I pretty much assumed I would go on to some sort of grad school. But I wanted to take a year off. And so I thought, well, I'll travel. And if I'm going to travel, then I'll go somewhere where I speak the language. So that meant either Spanish or Portuguese. And I spoke considerably better Spanish than Portuguese, so Spanish. And since I always, this is a very long logical process, and since I always assumed at that time that I would return to Miami, Miami's the jumping off point for journalists for decades have their bases that cover Central and South America have their base in Miami,
right?
Because there are more flights to more places in the Americas from Miami than anywhere south of there. So you can get to whatever it is you have to cover quicker. And I knew that in part because I, as a young man, I worked as a journalist. You know, and so I was aware of that, too. So I figured I'd go back to Miami eventually, you know, after a year abroad. So I thought, well, I'll go to the mother country. I'll get to know the culture that, you know, predates what all these other countries in the Americas, what they've inherited and what they've built off of. And so I went to Spain, and I was here for a couple of years. I took some intensive classes in Miami before coming over. So I... and made good friends with this teacher from Bogota, who said, oh, I know, you know, it was a chain of schools. So, oh, I know the woman who runs the school in Madrid. And so she gave me a letter of recommendation. Well, she gave me a business card of recommendation and with something written on the back. And she said, well, if you decide you want to stay, you know, go see Mrs. Valenzuela. And so when I ran out of money, I said, well, yeah, I think I want to stay a little longer. And so I went to see her, taught for it. So I was here for about 2 years. I did go back to the States, worked again as a journalist briefly, then did some teaching and so on. But I met my wife while I was here the first two years. And so I would come back and forth a couple times a year to visit and writing letters and so on. So I came back in 86 to be with her and to develop several projects that I had in mind. And I've been here since 86. I've been here longer than I've lived in the States, you know.
So, wow.
Yeah. Nobody ever comes here thinking you're going to stay, but you know, a lot of times that's the way it does. And, you know, my career started building here, and so friends would sometimes in the States would sometimes ask me, so when are you going to move back to the U.S.? You know, it's like, oh man, but I'd have to start all over again. you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I have good demos and good demo reel that I can show people as to what I do, but, you know, they've got to trust you and get you in the studio and see what you can do and how you work. And it takes a while. It takes 2-3 years to be able to build up a client base, in something like this.
But so, you do quite a bit of work for American companies, don't you, as well? So you'd still have some context within America.
True. But, you know, most of my work comes through ad agency. Well, not so much ad agencies nowadays, but used to come through ad agencies, production companies, the studios themselves. Not so often from the actual company. One exception would be Boston Consulting Group, for example, that I do a fair number of videos on an annual basis with them. But I'm always dealing with the Madrid office. One of the guy that I deal with the most is a wonderful, wonderful dude from Manchester, but who is also, you know, he's now becoming a lifer, I'm afraid, just like me, here in Madrid. but for the most part, I don't tend to deal directly with the companies. I usually have some sort of intermediary along the way.
Makes sense. And I suppose you've ended up in a good spot, because isn't Spain known for being one of the highest quality places for dubbing and like audio work?
Yes, it is. Yeah. I think you can,
for dubbing, you can, I would say from what I know, Mexico City, of course, is really, really good. But I would say the two best countries in the world for dubbing are probably Madrid, Spain and Egypt, curiously enough.
Why is that?
Well, Egypt, I learned this through, I worked on Spanish National Radio's shortwave broadcast. That was fun. I actually used to respond to a fair number of letters from New Zealand. The only country that probably has more sheep per person than Spain. we used to talk
that
about
would be accurate.
That we used to talk about lamb recipes every now and then with our listeners. But when I worked with them, there's a big Arabic language broadcast on the shortwave from Spain as well. And yes. Talking with my friends and so on and in the Arabic program, they explained to me that the Egyptian accent is probably a more open accent. And so it's very easy for people from other Arabic speaking countries to understand. However, there is a large range of accents in Arabic, and great distances. So it's not easy for a Moroccan to understand an Iraqi. However, they all understand the Egyptians. So yeah. Cairo is the center for dubbing films and television programs for all of the Arabic world, because everybody understands their accent. And that's really why they do it so well, because sheer volume. They do tons of films and so on. I had a friend here, spoke like 7 languages, Arabic family. I don't know where he was from originally, but he moved to Egypt years ago to work on the Disney films that they were. He was a composer and a singer, and he was working on adapting the Disney songs with Arabic lyrics for the Arabic market. And they do all that out of Egypt because they have this accent that is easily understood, you know. And I'm sure it depends on, you know, level of education and so on. If you get an Egyptian from the southern reaches of the desert, maybe it's not so easy to understand. But, you know, in metropolitan Cairo and the coastal areas, apparently it's a really easy accent for other Arabs to understand. So it's built up there. Mm-hmm. And, of course, here it was the same thing under the ancien regime of the Generalissimo, Franco's regime basically said they had a very chauvinistic attitude towards pushing what was Spanish and so on and so forth. So it was decreed you had to broadcast television, you had to show films in Spanish. It's kind of funny because they actually, it was, you were required to even pronounce foreign names as if they were Spanish, which is, so John Wayne, for a certain generation, probably most of whom have pretty much disappeared now. But, well, Spaniards live a long time. We have long life expectancy here.
They do.
Yeah, longest in Europe. There are people who know John Wayne as Juan Baine, because that's how you would say it in Spanish. But it's the sheer volume of the work that they do. So you've got all kinds of, you know, it's a very advanced dubbing culture.
Yeah, makes sense. So I suppose you're at the point of your career where you don't actually have to go out looking for work. You get approached. I mean, I imagine that was the case with Mercury Steam. They came to you?
Yes.
Or did they go through an ad agency to get to you?
No, they went, I think they found me through the studio. I don't actually remember, but I believe they found me through the studio. But they may, you know, because that was, well, they might have found me on LinkedIn, perhaps diving into the searches and so on and so forth. But I think they found me through the studio. And also, I've been here so long. It's always amazing to me that how many studios there are. There are always new small studios that I've never been to or haven't heard of. Occasionally voice talent that I don't know. But I've been here so long that I'm probably the best known, you know. Oh, well, talk to Steve, you know, kind of thing. And because I've done a lot of this sort of things, casting and as well as directing and so on, you know, and I know more people. I get calls from people asking me for voices in other languages even. You know, I'll get calls from clients who say, oh, Steve, you know, I need a 35-year-old Italian woman, you know? And if I do, I'll pass it along. If I don't, well, I'll tell them that too. I don't want to send somebody that I don't have complete confidence in. But yeah, I think that came through the studio that they had recorded with them before.
Because you did Castlevania 2 with them, I think, before you did the Metroid Dread work. So you'd obviously
before
built
Metroid
up a bit.
Before Space Lords and before Space Lords.
Yeah, yeah. So you'd already built up rapport with them before you even got to Metroid Dread.
Now that I'm remembering that I did some scratch track work for them indirectly through another very small studio on the outskirts of Madrid. So that may actually have been where the connection came through, where I was doing the scratch track for some earlier work they were doing for the Castlevania.
What's a scratch track?
A
draft?
That may actually be more animation jargon, but a scratch track is when you record an initial track, mostly for timing. It also helps the animators to try and envision what the scene is going to look like. It's really fun. That's one of the fun things about doing animation is when you do really good animation, you actually record the voices first. Then they animate to what you've recorded.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Instead of trying to have to fit your voice in there.
Because they have to synchronize the mouth to work with what's been recorded.
Every now and then you'll get
there where the animation is done except the mouth, or, you know, it's a halfway process. So then you'll time your acting for the animation to what you're seeing on screen, but you don't actually have to fit it in the mouth because the mouth hasn't been animated yet. So there sometimes is a half midway process too. But so the scratch track is that early one. I've done a lot of work with an excellent animation company here called The Spa. Which SPA comes from Sergio Pablos Animation, who's the he's a former Disney animator and so on, and he's been put out some very good films like Klaus, which was broadcast on Netflix a couple years ago. He's working on another one now, but it's, you know, animation is kind of tough on the platforms right now, so I think he's looking for still looking for where it's going to be distributed. But he does, you know, they do some great stuff. And I've done a whole bunch of scratch track work for them. There, in case they sometimes, they actually often do go then to Hollywood for bigger names with more marquee value, who actually do dub the animated mouth. But I've done a number of films here where we've done the original voices. We actually recorded the original voices. There was no scratch track, essentially, or, you know, we substituted some stuff. So, you know, we've done quite a lot of that. And it's great fun to see later on the results of when you're how the animators interpret what you've voiced, because, you know,
Yeah, well, you do, right.
Yeah. No, I did this crazy, English chameleon once. we do some strange things. And it, just because of the way he was very over the top, sort of a conspiranoid character. And the way I did one particular line, the animator said, oh, I can have him do this. So he had him grab another character's leg, run up his body, and like finish right in his face to when he, you know, finished the line. I never would have imagined that was what was going to happen on screen. And apparently it was totally, it came to the animator because of the way I, listening to what my voice did, he said, oh, I can have him move like this, you know, which was, that was a real treat.
So is that the same with video games? You do the dialogue first and then they animate it, or is it a combination of both?
No, generally speaking, no. Sometimes they will animate the interstitial content between, you know, between gameplay sections when they've got those scenes that connect the different parts. Sometimes they'll animate that afterwards. Other times they've already got it animated. But most of what we do in video games, of course, most of it's actually off screen. So they don't really have to, you know, they can, they don't have to worry too much about animating afterwards. You know, I mean, during the gameplay itself, usually all we're doing is vocal gestures, you know, getting hit. These are some of the weird things that we do, you know. Steve, I want you to get hit five times, five different ways, okay? Steve, you got to hit somebody else. All right, do a big windup, okay? Straight, you know, little jab, you know, things like that. We have to do a whole bunch of stuff like that. But the conversation is, you know, the dialogue is mostly in between. So
with Metroid Dread, you were basically speaking a language that doesn't exist. Well, like a made-up language. Pretty much, right? When you did the dialogue for it.
I'm not sure if, are you talking about Samus or?
Not Samus, because that was voiced by Nikki Garcia, right? Did you direct her, by the way? Did you direct her doing that? Or was that done by someone else? Nikki Garcia, when she did the vocal in Metroid Dread, because I know you directed her recently. With the Spanish podcast, isn't it? Some sort of fiction Spanish podcast.
That was very successful in Spanish, and now they want to launch it on the English market.
That's cool. But did you direct anyone, or is it just you in the booth during that period?
Well, to be honest, she didn't need any direction.
That's how good she is. No,
it was
amazing to watch her do that, and how quickly she made the text was basically made up. It's not like Tolkien, you know, basically inventing, taking time and inventing an actual language. No, this was kind of, you know, gibberish in a sense, but it was good sounding gibberish and it looked good on the page, but it really, there was no way for her to know what she was saying. However, she took she took hold of that text and she did it practically on the first go.
And it's basically and one
it
line
really,
as well.
It really sounded like what
she knew what she was saying. And she, you know, she couldn't know what she was saying, but it sure sounded like it. I would have a really hard time doing that, frankly. I would have a really hard time doing that.
But you had to do a lot longer, though. Like, your section was a lot bigger, and I imagine you did it in parts.
And I do tend to direct.
Most, if they call me to get the voices, they frequently also ask me, the directors, of course, are Spanish, and they, even though they may have a very good command of English, for example, Enrique Alvarez of Mercury Steam, you know, has a great command of English. He has no trouble at all. But he's had me there. He's had me there to, let's say, assistant direct as kind of a backup. Because just in case something gets away from them that he doesn't pick up on, maybe from pronunciation, also inflections, I'll frequently come in and say, how about if we do it this way? Because I also like to, with something like that, I prefer that the production company have at least two or three variations, because until they actually start to put the dialogue together, a lot of times you don't know, and this happens with animation too, until you start to put the dialogue together, you're not always sure exactly what kind of inflection you want. And you may choose one take over another depending upon what was said before or what's coming after, and you know which ones the other takes that you choose. So they often have me there helping to direct and suggesting different inflections, different reads, making sure that the voice projection is, well, they usually pick up on that because you know they're amazingly, someone like Enrique is game directors are a lot like film directors, and I compare them both to orchestral directors, you know, symphony conductors, not directors. Sorry, that was Spanglish. I've been here too long. Symphony conductors. I'm amazed. Symphony conductors have the whole score in their head, and they, you know, they're listening to so many different things at the same time. Whereas most of us, we're lucky if we can listen to two instruments at the same time or three at most, you know. And they pick it all. Mm. They pick it all out, and they can put it all together. I once was sitting in on a rehearsal for the Cabrillo Contemporary Classical Music Festival, and the great composer Dennis Russell Davies, who concentrates on 20th and now 21st century music. The timpanist was having trouble coming in on a very difficult piece, and I watched him on the fifth attempt. The timpanist finally found his entry, but Russell Davies was there saying, after the trumpet does this, boom, didn't work. And he didn't get angry. He was really cool, which was great. He said, after that, you know, you come in. He said, no, okay, well, listen to the clarinet. And it was like, he pulled it right up. He didn't even have to look at the score. It was like, you know, here's where you come in. Take your cue from him. It was one after another. Well, game directors have to do the same thing. They have to have this global vision of how all this comes together. First of all, in the gameplay, and then later, you know, with the scenes that we do of dialogue and so on, they have to have the whole thing there, and they're on top of that. So rarely will we like shout when we're not supposed to, or not shout when we should be shouting because we're too far away from each other. He's got all that in his head, you know, all the time.
Right. So is he guiding you, or is there any visual cue at all? Like, can you see anything on a screen, or is it just you looking at the words and just saying them?
Usually, it's just us looking at the words. Occasionally, we have done some stuff, for example, with Mercury Steam, where the scene was already pretty well animated, so we had to time what we were doing to what was on screen.
Oh, the flaps.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And yeah. So we had to
time it in there. You know, which is basic dubbing. It's always, you know, those mouths aren't as complicated as the human mouth. So there's a little bit of room for a fudge factor, you know, that's fairly normal.
Yeah.
So
yeah, there's something I want to show you because I find this extremely fascinating. I'm just going to share my screen with you. Okay, can you see my screen?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So some Metroid fan. Very, very devout Metroid fan has taken the language that was used in Metroid Dread and and did the translation in English, if you can see all this stuff.
Yes, yes. Yeah, no, they definitely did create that at the time. They definitely did create that. The thing is that, you know, they did a lot of work to try to precisely to be able to try to make it sound like a real language. They did create that. The thing is that Nikki, of course, didn't take a 3-month course in whatever you want to call
language. It's Chozo. Chozo language. There you go.
She didn't actually know what she was saying. You know, even though that's true, even though they did design a language there, she didn't actually know what she was saying at the time. But she just has such a great sense of language that she was able to adapt it. Although I don't know, I'd have to ask her. Maybe they gave her the translation before she did the voiceover, but you know, the voice acting. But I don't remember. Oh, wait a minute. No,
actual dialogue for the actual cutscene. So some devout fan has written the English and then exactly what you've said right underneath it, right? In the actual cutscene.
We had both, so we have some sense of
reference. Because I've got the thing here, like this is your original.
No, it's when you put that up on screen there with the on the script, I thought, where did you get the script? So somebody has actually done a really good job of reconstructing the script that we now that's dedication, and then that's smarts. Yeah, done a really good job of reconstructing our script.
There's some devout fans out there. And so, I mean, when you're trying to say a language that doesn't exist, you've got no reference points. So I'm wondering how you convey, especially subtleties, inflections, that sort of stuff, when you're dealing with construct a language.
Yeah, part of it, I think, is there is a parallelism there. I mean, they did do one of the fortunate things. It's not like German where the verb is always at the very end of the sentence. When they did the language, they kept the syntactical structure pretty much of English, in part so that we could say it with a where it would make some sense, where it would sound like it would make sense, that it sounded like it made sense, and it did. But I mean, because they kept the same syntax, so we could kind of follow the way English would flow, but with different words. And part of it is just plain saying things with conviction. Sometimes you, excuse me, you learn sometimes, like in advertising and so on, if you say things like you really believe it, the people who listen to you will too. And
that's right. And
including the client, because sometimes the client will ask you to do things that you don't really see, but they insist on it. So if you do what they ask you to do with real conviction and a smile in your voice, it'll work. I've had to say things that were even ungrammatical and, which grated on my ears. And I was sure that, most native speakers would say, "Ooh, did he really say what I think he said?" But the client insisted on it, so I had to say it, and I did. I said it just like I was speaking the Queen's English perfectly.
It's interesting you say that, because I've always felt, I don't know if you agree with this, but I always felt that sort of bravado and the confidence level it comes a lot more naturally to Americans, I feel. You seem to be naturally good at it. You can say stuff with so much conviction. Even if it's not true.
No, it could be. It could be. I mean, we are given, for example, to not overstatement. I guess that word exists. I think we say understatement more often, but it's one of the things they often contrast between Brits and Americans. Now, there's some old joke about, that when something is okay, a Brit will say it's not bad, and an American will say, "Oh, it's great," means it's okay. And we're certainly given to that. And that probably makes it a little bit easier. Plus, a certain culture of confidence in general, deservedly or not, and we teach kids to be confident. We also teach kids to, in school, they do a lot of stuff that's presentations from a very young age. I probably stood up in front of the class and gave my first book report, which is probably all of about five or six sentences, when I was in second grade. So you learn pretty quickly to unwrap yourself, as the Spaniards would say.
Anaman henki maradis pisalakuta ilizoja hasana.
So that's you.
Yeah.
So I am wondering how you found that voice to use. Like, is it just a matter of trying to dig a little deeper and get a bit raspier? Or some of that effects as well?
A lot of air.
Of course, it's heavily filtered as well. But yes, it was probably, most likely, was something with a lot of air. Because we probably had some conversation between the director and I, and we said, "What are you hearing? What is it you want?" And then so okay, give him a lot of air. Maybe not quite as much as I just did just now, because if you do that much, well, then I may have done it a little less airy, a little less breathy, because that is heavily filtered. If you go, if you do too much of that, and then they filter it too much, you may become difficult to understand. But yeah, no, I think that was pretty much it. It was making it, taking it down a bit more in the throat.
Open up the air.
Using, it can be a real problem to do this for a very long time.
Yeah, I imagine
because it will kind of
destroy your throat if you're and this is one of the things with animation and also to an extent with video games. You got to be careful with the voice you invent because you got to know can you scream with that? Can you shout with that? You know, sometimes people, you know, or you know, Disney stuff. Can you sing with that? You know, with that voice, you have to be a little bit careful of what you. What you invent, depending upon what you're going to have to do with it later on. If you're really forcing your voice, and then you have to, with what the voice is, and then you have to force it with the way you're expressing with that voice, you can damage yourself if you do a whole lot of it.
I have spoken to voice actors, and obviously they keep like lemon water and honey close. I'm not sure if you use anything like that as well.
If I know I'm going to have a really tough day, I take a combination of vitamin A and E. I started taking vitamin A because it's really good to repair the vocal cords. I've recommended it to a lot of my colleagues and to friends of mine who are musicians, because here in Madrid, a number of the voice actors are also musicians. And so vitamin A helps it, you know, it repairs a lot of different types of tissue, but it does repair the vocal cords. And then a friend of mine who's a doctor said, oh, no, but you should be taking A plus E. So I take a high dose of A and E together, because he said the E increases the circulation. So more of the A gets to the vocal cords. So if I know I'm going to have a really tough day, I'll take one of those before I leave the house. I take another one when I get back home, and I probably take another one the following morning. And if I'm surprised by something that I have to do a lot of shouting or something like that, and I can feel, then as soon as I get home, I take that.
Do you avoid certain foods like, say, like dairy, which produces a lot of mucus, or maybe even high amounts of like spices or stuff that has like canola oil or vegetable oil?
Spices don't worry me too much. I do tend to avoid dairy, but mostly because it often makes you click a lot. So I tend to do more. I might take chamomile tea, which of course is soothing as well. And I tend to drink my coffee black and American style with a fair amount of water. So that's not quite as much of a problem. Although if you take a lot, that'll dry out your mouth and make it clicky as well. It's curious, in Spanish, you don't see so much of it anymore, because in the old days, in the large dubbing studios in Madrid, pretty much all of them have their own coffee shop because they would have their own staff. I mean, there was enough money in the business. Now things are budgets have been so squeezed that nobody has their own, you know, waiter and cafeteria. They've got a machine. But back then they had things to eat and so on, because, you know, people are coming in and out. You know, they'll go in and they might go into one room to work on one film. They'll come out, and then an hour later they go to another studio in the same company to do a different film. Or they might be called back in because someone came in briefly and then they'll go out. But anyway, to make a short story long, in those cafeterias, they always had cans of anchovies. First of all, Spaniards have among the best preserved fish and shellfish anywhere. Not that there aren't other countries that don't have really, really good ones, but their anchovies are really small and really, really good. It's nothing like the hairy fish that we used to refer to as the anchovies on the pizzas in the United States, where like you had all the bones in there and you noticed it. You know, they're really small. But anyway, those are canned. They're preserved in olive oil, and they're salty. So when somebody would get clicky, they would often go to the cafeteria and have an anchovy. One. Mouth starts to salivate, the olive oil smooths out some of the other things that are going on in your mouth, and the clicks disappear. Nowadays, people have pretty much forgotten that because you don't want to do too much. You don't want to do too much citrus because citrus is.
Well, it produces a lot of acid.
Yeah, exactly. It's acidic. So you don't normally want to do too much of that. A little bit of it's good, I think, because it again, it makes you salivate. But too much of it, it's what do we call it? Astringent as well, you know. So you don't want to overdo that. Just as you don't want to overdo the anchovies. You don't want to have a mouthful of olive oil. But one or maybe two, that will actually make you get your mouth working again, and that works really well. So, you know. Yeah, it's kind of funny. It's even water. You have to even be careful with water. Water, if you overhydrate, your stomach starts gurgling.
and that can come out in the recording.
Exactly. You know, it's like, oh, geez, my guts again. You know, and nice take. Too bad we could hear your stomach growling. So, you know, you can overdo that too. So it's a little tricky. But yeah, you do want to avoid certain kinds of things. You want to avoid mints as well. Mints are not
mints.
Yeah, whether it's wintergreen or spearmint or mints in general.
Right, mints. Yeah. I thought you meant like mints as in, you know, beef and that sort of mints.
Oh, yeah.
So I was thinking, what?
Yeah. Yes.
TS rather than CE. Yes. Yeah, you want to avoid anything made with any sort of mint because if I'd said it in singular, it would have been a lot easier to understand because it also will affect your vocal cords. It's kind of astringent and so on. You want to try to stay away from that.
So I suppose it's just best to just not eat or drink as little as possible before you're doing a recording or maybe a day before?
Well, I think just an hour or so before is fine, maybe to not overdo the coffee, not overdo tea with milk or coffee with milk, you know, and there are some things like, as I say, chamomile or certain herbal teas. There's one over here that's excellent. It's called... it's a European brand, but when you buy the box, on one side it's in Italian, another side it's in English, another side it's in Spanish, and I guess the fourth side is probably French. It's a combination of, like, licorice, for example, can actually be very soothing, at least in, you know, small quantities combined with several other herbs. Those kinds of things are good as well. But yeah, I think the main thing is you want to stay hydrated because you need your vocal cords to be hydrated, but you don't want to overdo it. It's like everything, moderation in all things.
Indeed.
Just be a little careful about, yeah, but dairy is definitely something you want to stay away from because, it'll produce phlegm that can even get caught down in here. So you're constantly, which is a real pain. And as I say, it'll make your mouth clicky, you know, so you want to stay away from cheese, you know, for example, too, not just milk.
Mm. Yeah, so. Something I wanted to ask you about is AI and its, I suppose, the possible effect it will have on voice actors, right? And the way people are using it, well, to manipulate voices. I think that there was one that you commented on with Stephen Fry, you know, how they used his voice illegally. You know, and produce something. Yeah. Are you at all concerned about this? Are you like, what's your thoughts on it?
Oh, geez, I have a lot of thoughts on it, but I'll try not to go overboard. Yeah, the case with Stephen Fry, they actually copied his voice and just used it without asking for his permission or anything else. Mm. And they not only couldn't just do it without it, they couldn't have done it. Unless they paid him, you know, and he signed a contract and so on. It's part of, you know, you can't use his face. Well, you can't use his voice either, logically. Now the controversy about what the voice that OpenAI has brought out that sounds suspiciously like Scarlett Johansson, who was asked to be a voice and said no. Now, they may have... They very possibly built a voice that sounds like her using other voices and, you know, tweaking here and there, which is kind of, you know, I don't know what the word is, but it's like, it's not nice. You know, it's just, you know, the woman said no. don't come out with an imitator, you know, that then sounds like her. It just, you know, it just doesn't quite sit well with me. But I'm not keen on a lot of that stuff, but it comes, to say the least, it comes on the heels of what a lot of the tech business is, which is, you know, and especially the AI. AI is built, whether it's chatbots or whatever, off of scraping information from all over the internet without asking permission from the sources that they've taken it from. They're building these products using the production and the work of other people who are not getting compensated for that. And in some cases, as with, you know, writing, they're using that to then later put other people out of work. And sometimes the people that they've actually scraped material from in the long run, not specifically, but generally. And that's their view is that, you know, obviously these AI companies, their view is that anything that's out there is fair game. Sometimes it is, unfortunately. A lot of times it's not, but they may use it anyway because who's going to know? It's like, you know, training the large language models. They've done it by scraping tons of books and magazine articles and newspaper articles and so on and so forth. How are you going to know that they've scraped it unless you have, you know, internal documents from those companies? That's complicated. As far as my concerns go, I am concerned in some ways. I'm not concerned in others.
Well, you are a jack of all trades. So my view is this, that you need to be a jack of all trades as opposed to a master of one. Because if AI comes along and makes one particular thing obsolete, then at least you've got all these different other skill sets that you can rely on. Sure. Which, and you definitely fall into that category. So I think you are okay.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I've adapted, sometimes intentionally, sometimes not. I don't do a whole lot of advertising anymore because here in Spain, you know, in English, most of what we do with advertising is not. I mean, I've done some things for cable television in the U.S. I've done, you know, radio spots for radio in the U.K., different stuff like that. But most of what we do in advertising in English here, or used to do, was either for advertising film festivals, where we would do an English version so that the multilingual, you know, the audience and especially the jury could understand what was going on. Right. Or we were doing versions for the Home Office in Paris, in London, in New York, to see what they were doing with their advertising in the U.S. It wasn't generally for broadcast. Now with the internet, of course, we do a lot of stuff that is, you know, not only, you know, that's all over the world. So that part has changed. Online advertising, yes, we are doing more of. The other stuff we're doing a lot less of for a variety of reasons that we still do the Home Office stuff, but the film festivals, no, because they've changed to do using broadcasting the original version with subtitles. I was told because nowadays a lot of the jury members don't speak good enough English to be able to follow the English version of the ad. I don't know. That's just what I've been told. But what worries me about so I'm not I've always had to adapt. I do a lot of documentaries, for example, because I've gotten known among the documentary directors and producers, which is a very tight-knit, small world, and they'll, you know, recommend, you know, one guy will recommend me to another. They're not worried about, Steve is my voice. No, they recommend from one to another. I love doing documentaries, too, because I just learn. It's one of the great things of what I do is that every job is different, and I learn stuff all the time, both as a voice artist and as a person by the jobs that I do. So it's fascinating. It's fun. You know, it's a little bit like being a journalist. And a journalist, every story is different. You know, that's part of the good thing of being, or what you're doing. Every interview is different. Every person is different. The questions that you can ask, the personality of the person that you've got on the other side of the screen. Everyone is different, which is certainly a lot more fun, you know. What worries me a little bit about AI, we've seen it in certain kinds of the work has definitely fallen off in certain types of jobs. I'm not being too badly hurt by it, but my colleagues have definitely commented it since the pandemic, I guess, basically, but especially in the last 2-3 years. Corporate videos, especially internal corporate videos, educational stuff, things where they really want to save money, and where they don't care too much how good the voice recording is. AI has gotten to a point where it's pretty good, but it's not great. It will get better.
It's not quite there. Yeah.
No. The last time I was in the States, I'm watching television, I think I picked up on, I counted like three television commercials that I thought, I think that was done with AI. Or it was done with AI or by a really mediocre voice actor.
But here's the thing, though. Because you're in this industry, you can hone in on it. You can hear these things straight away, right? I don't think the average Joe would be able to pick up on it. I mean, I can pick up on it as well. But
of course.
Most people wouldn't.
You have a trained ear. No, you're absolutely right. Most people won't necessarily notice, that's a synthetic voice. However, what I think the end clients, particularly advertisers, but others, underestimate is that oral communication is, first of all, it's incredibly complex. That's a whole other question as to how far AI can go with synthetic voices. But in particular, the audience picks up all kinds of things, whether they're aware of it or not. And how well you do certain things, you can hook the audience or you can lose them. And the AI may be competent. It may not jump off the screen towards the viewer saying, oh, I'm a synthetic voice. No, that they've gotten beyond that stage. But that doesn't mean you've really hooked them in to buy your product. It's like I have, if you're doing internal communications with a company, maybe you want to, maybe you're fine with it being that may be okay. If you're doing educational stuff and you don't care about boring the kids, which you may bore them anyway with a human voice, that may be fine. But if you're trying to sell something or if you're trying to motivate people or things like that, there's that last 5% or so, maybe it's 10%, maybe it's 2%, but that last 5% or so that really makes the difference, I personally don't think AI will ever be able to do that because it's not so simple. You can't just push a fader and say, make it more interesting. You can't just turn a knob and say, make it brighter.
Yeah.
Or make it warmer. You have there's a whole series of things there that you have to do. I have corporate clients who literally, I've had more than one. We finished a rather leaden corporate video that they had to do because they had to communicate the information. Oh man, Steve, really, thanks so much. Great. It was wonderful hearing, listening. You really made it sound like it was interesting. when they were saying this is really, really boring stuff and you made it sound like you actually liked it and were interested. Well, yeah, a person can do that, especially somebody, as the Spaniards say, when someone has a lot of experience, they say tiene tablas, which means you have boards, which comes from the theater world. It means you've been on the stage a lot, right? So I've been up on this stage a lot and I've learned a lot of things about how to do it and how to do this. And yeah, I'm pretty good at making a 4-minute video about, I don't know, could be something really boring in terms of marketing or whatever. But I can actually make it sound like this is really interesting stuff and it's really going to be good for you to know, and that's important. I don't think, and it's sometimes hard to say exactly how you do that. My concern right now with the AI, for example, is that the things that are being done on AI are precisely the kinds of jobs that young voice actors who are just starting out cut their teeth on. Educational videos, corporate videos, stuff for trade fairs. I do a lot of stuff for trade fairs and so on and so forth to help the sales force sell in the at the Stuttgart Fair, that sort of, it's support material. Those are things that are relatively straightforward, and those are the kinds of things that you learn the trade with. So I think we're seeing that there's like what's we're continuing to do with human voices are things that are particularly difficult, and the things that are easy and where you learn the trade are now being shunted towards the synthetic voices, which I can understand. I mean, you know, for years now, they've been talking about the people who are going to have success in their jobs in the future in any sector, in any industry, are the people who can adapt the fastest. Everything changes. Everything evolves. There's nothing, you know.
That's right.
All those people who used to shoe horses, you know, had to learn to do something else with their hammers once the car came along, you know. There's all sorts of things that, you know, you just don't do anymore because it's been automatized or mechanized or just we just don't use it anymore. That's us too, as voice artists. Personally, I suspect, looking into the future, I suspect that the voice actor sector, I think it will continue to exist. I think it will actually bounce back a bit in about 10 or 15 years. But because of the places where you can use synthetic voices and successfully, I think we're going to find that the voice actor business will be dominated by actors. Because people aren't going to be able to cut their teeth on simple jobs, some people will come out of radio, as always, you know. Some people here in Spain, almost everybody in advertising either came out of radio or came out of dubbing for a long time. There was those two ways into that subsector, no? But I think it's going to be good news for actors because we all know that, you know, the vast majority of actors have to work really hard, you know, to make their monthly nut.
It's a hard thing. Anybody in the creative industry on this, it's really only the top 1% that really make the bulk of the money, and everyone else is fighting for the breadcrumbs.
So I think what's going to happen is that people who dedicate themselves exclusively to voice acting are probably going to have a very hard time. And I think more actors, and it will probably be looked at more kindly. You know, a lot of actors will probably supplement their income with voice acting. Many probably do already. I can't really, you know, vouch for that. But I know people here, for example. I know a guy, he's fabulous. I did a very early radio spot with this guy. It was so much fun. It was for the Spanish National Organization for the Blind, which actually does charity work and provides education and opportunities and job training and so on, not just for the blind, but also for the deaf. And, you know, even it just hasn't changed its name. But they have a lottery. There are two people sell the lottery in Spain, the National Organization for the Blind and the state. and the National Organization for the Blind does these ads because they need to sell, you know, their lottery tickets. And we were doing one. This guy was a civilian taxi driver with a really thick, heavy Andalusian accent, civilian accent. He is, and this guy is from Andalusia. And I was a rather naive, because I had to sound like that, American tourist. Because also that's kind of the, you know, they, for a long time, they had the image of Americans as being kind of childish, you know, naive and so on. So I had to do that. But the whole radio ad was in Spanish. So I had to do that with a heavy American accent, heavier than I had even back then. But this guy Juan, you know, he's a voice actor, he's a stage actor, he's a film actor, he's a television actor. He does it all. Because also, if you're a stage actor, you can. It's very easy to combine that because of your schedules. You know, performances are at night. Rehearsals are usually in the afternoon. You got your mornings free, or oftentimes your afternoons free to record. You have to, you know, as you say, you have to be a jack of all trades. I'm a jack of all trades in voice work. I've also appeared in front of the camera a few times, but that's been just, you know, kind of coincidental, where I've worked with somebody and said, "Oh, why don't you do this?" You know, and, okay, cool. I'm cool with that. It's fun. I'd love to do more of it, but I haven't actually sought it out. And as you said before, I haven't had to sell myself too much because my work has adapted and I've adapted. As advertising fell off, I was doing more and more documentaries, and I continued to grow my corporate side. So I was already working a lot. It didn't make much sense to then promote myself to the ad agencies, although that's the most profitable work, because I really didn't have time to do more. You know,
well, you're busy as it is.
Yeah, well, exactly. So, you know, it's not like, you know, if work time kind of falls off, yeah. There are a lot of people I only do one or two jobs for a year, but I do it every year, you know. And I probably bill, I'd have to look, but I must bill at least 80 or 90 companies every year for different, you know. And that's not even the end clients. Those are the production companies and the studios. And then if you count, you know, who the jobs were actually done for, you know, it's even more companies that I'm somehow involved with, you know. And that's a key to it, is to spread out as much as you can, do as much as you can. But I, personally, I think, you know, the synthetic voices are going to be, to a degree, a fad that will last 5 or 10 years. And then
I hope you're right.
Well, I think what people will realize is that there's several factors there. That last 5 to 2% that really makes the difference between a competent or good voiceover or voice job and a really brilliant one, that only a human can do. You know, and I think if you don't understand that, you're I was about to say a Bushism. I was going to say misunderestimating. I think President Bush said that once. I think they're underestimating the complexity of oral communication and how many nuances there are. And maybe you could do that with AI, but you'd still have to do the original, generate the original recording, then sit down with a sound engineer and say, okay, here I want it a little more like this. Here I want it a little more like that. Take this up. Take that. I want to change the inflection here. Can you make that a little brighter? Can you make that a little warmer? In the end, they're going to spend more money revising that AI-generated voiceover with a sound engineer than recording it with a human to begin with, if they know what they're doing. You know, because you get into a studio and frequently the client doesn't really know, especially advertising, doesn't really know what they want. And you interpret the text that you've got in front of you. That's why it is acting. And you do it the way you think. And then they come back to you and say, well, could you do it a little more like this in this line? Could you close this off more? Could you be give it a bit more punch here? You know, you don't have buttons there for punch and for, you know, conviction.
Sometimes I hear very bad voice acting. I heard the English dub of Money Heist. The voice acting was pretty bad in the English dub. But I'm wondering if that's a voice actor problem, or do you think it's the director giving the wrong direction or not knowing what they want?
Could be three things. One could be that the actor is not particularly good. Let's face it, dubbing in English was terrible for so long. We did very little of it. We didn't really know how to do it properly. That's changing to a degree. There are British universities now that, for example, there's a British university, I want to say Sheffield, but I don't think it is Sheffield, that has
in
a
Madrid.
Course.
In
no,
Madrid.
No, in has a course in the UK.
Oh, right.
To,
okay.
For script adaptation for dubbing, which is a very specific skill that has been glaringly lacking in the UK and in the US. People don't know how to adapt a script to what's on screen. That's a huge step in the process of dubbing.
Because you can't just directly translate, can you? Like, say,
no.
I mean, I know because my wife speaks Hindi, and I know if you were to directly translate it, it would be backwards. It would be like Yoda. So like, say, if I say, Namaste, Midanam, Reese, Hey. That means, hi, my name is Reese. But if you were to directly translate it, it would be Reese, my name is. Right? So it's backwards. Is that the same with Spanish? Is that how it works?
To a large degree.
Because Spanish, the Spanish syntax is similar to English syntax much of the time, but there are things that are turned around. And because it's a Latinate language, I guess, It's also much more flexible in how you can switch words around, and frequently also the way you switch the words around will change the connotation. You know, it's not the same to say yo lo haré and lo haré yo. I'll do it. One is saying I'll do it, and the other one saying I'll do it. By putting the yo, the I at the end, you're giving it a special punch, and you're saying no, you're not going to do it. I'm going to do it. You know, I don't want him to do it. I'm going to do it. And that's just by changing the order and you may give it a bit more punch. But so, yeah, there's a fair amount of that. And so actually here, there are translators who are, it's a three-step process. First process is take the script and translate it. There are translators here who are specially trained to translate to dub.
But when you say translate, do you mean like directly translate and then fix it up, or are they doing that at the same time while they're translating?
That's why I say there's specialized translators who know how to translate to dub, because they don't make certain simple mistakes. You know, sometimes people for a literary translation, they'll say, you know, well, if you come to Madrid, ring me, you know, give me a call. And then they'll translate it into this, you know, into the other language, and they'll say, give me a call if you come to Madrid. No. if you come to Madrid there, maintain that syntax so at least Madrid is in the same place, so I can nail that. You know, when I dub it, Madrid will be Madrid. It won't be some other word. Don't move things around like that. That's a beginner's mistake, you know. That's why sometimes I get these things, especially for corporate things that they want to dub. They do that too. Sometimes they'll say, oh no, we've got a great translation. And it's like, it's useless for me, you know, because they've taken all kinds of liberties with the text and they've changed the syntax and so on. And it's faster for me to retranslate it than it is to fix it. So when you're doing actual dubbing a film, for example, first step is a translator who translates for dubbing, and they also are very aware of it. When I translate, I don't have time to do it anymore, but when I used to translate to dub, the first thing I actually did is I'd go through the film and mark out on the script what was on screen and what was off screen, because what's off screen I can translate however I want. What's on screen is what I have to worry about. Where are the labials? Where are the fricatives? You know, labial B and P. Where are the Fs and the Vs? Where are the visible vowels? Where are the Os and the Us? You know, an A or an E, you can kind of get away with an A or an E because A, E, you don't really see that so much in the mouth, you know? I used to do dialogue coaching for advertising here years ago, where they would bring in really good actors, because there's a much bigger pool of actors from New York or London, to do TV commercials here, because most of the actors here, it's a smaller community, the faces are known. So if you're not looking for a spokesman for your brand, if you want a really good actor, not a model, because a lot of times they would use models and they don't know how to act, and so it's kind of wooden. So they would bring in these actors. Frequently, they didn't speak Spanish. I used to train them. I would teach them their dialogue. 30 seconds, they can do it. Plus, especially the Brits, I mean, the stage actors are so accustomed to learning scripts quickly. These guys would learn it, and they learn how to play with it. I mean, it was amazing to work with stage actors from London. You know, I would teach them how to do it. And I always told them, you know, they would be nervous. And I said, don't worry about it. I'll be there. I'll be supervising. I'll be watching on the monitor. If you make a mistake, just keep going. First of all, it may not be a master take. They may use different cuts. Second of all, if we can't see your mistake, it doesn't matter, because they're going to dub you anyway, because they were doing, you know, they'd dub them with a native speaker. So as long as you didn't put a big O where it was an A, or put a B where there was nothing, that's fine. You know, you can't see it. It's never perfect anyway when you do a dub. There's always a little bit, although every now and then, you know, we've dubbed close to around 100 films for in-flight entertainment for Iberia Airlines for over a 15-year period. And, you know, there were occasionally scenes when we were finishing dubbing. I worked a lot with a particular director, and we would finish it and say, damn, can we say that? I guess so. Damn, that really looks like we were speaking English, like they were speaking English, you know, when it's really, really well adjusted. So first they translate to help you to get everything to in the right places for what's on screen. Then you have an adjuster. And if it's a really good one, that's a person who just adjusts. So they take the translation, they take what's on screen, and then they tweak the translation so that B's and P's are where you, you know, close your mouth, that things don't go over too long, that, you know, these sorts of sounds, you adjust it to what's on screen. And then finally, the director goes through it and may do a little bit more tweaking even before recording then too. And I always find that even in the studio, you still end up changing stuff till you're actually recording it. There's still things you say, you know, it would look better if you said this. And it suddenly pops into your head. You know, there's a sixth sense there sometimes, you know, and it's a way of playing with language. If you're a language person, you get that sort of thing. And when you've done more of it, you know, it's that much easier. But yeah, that's a crucial step that's not done that they're just learning to do. Another part is, you know, since dubbing has been bad, it's been hard for good actors to participate in dubbing because it's looked down upon. Here, it's not. The original dubbers back in the 40s were stage actors in Madrid. And there's two reasons for that. One is they're actors. They know how to act. Two, they're guys who know how to whisper. They know how to whisper so that you can hear them in the last row. You don't whisper like this in dubbing. Because, you know, the air, if it's all air, you can't hear it. You got to use a little bit of your chest when you're whispering. And there's a series of things like that. It's like learning how to shout. You know, if there's a distance there on screen, you, depending upon how they do it, you might actually shout and they just lower the gain on the microphone and so on and so forth. But for a lot of jobs, too, you got to learn how to shout where you're not actually shouting, but it sounds like it because you're projecting in a certain way where, you know, it sounds like you're shouting twice as loud. Got to learn how to do that stuff, too. You know, voice actors, I think, in the future will do. I mean, actors in the future, I think, will do more voice acting and hopefully dubbing as well, because, they won't have so many problems. But they're going to have to learn how to work the mic in ways that dubbing actors do, for example. I always tell people here who want to get into voice acting, I tell them, even if you don't want to go into dubbing, I recommend that you take, you know, at least 6 months or a year of dubbing classes as well, because dubbing teaches you other ways to project your voice, other ways to use your voice that straight voice acting 98% of the time you don't need, and so you don't learn. It also teaches you to act more, which is always, we're voice actors. No matter what you're doing, even if you're reading an educational text, you're adopting a certain role. And you're communicating to a certain audience or corporate videos. There's you don't have to be playing a fictional role to be acting. It's always acting. Mm. That's why, you know, that term has become so common now. And I think the other thing is that dubbing classes also teach you how to work the mic more. If you go out of the plane of the mic, it sounds like you're in the next room. If you're right in front of it, getting some distance on it. That's another thing that bothers me with certain dubbing. Sometimes it sounds like they're all prima donnas and they're right up on the mic, and it says, you know, the guy's standing 3 yards away. You shouldn't sound like that. You know, and don't put all the onus on the sound tech. Oh no, he can fix it. No, he can make it better. But as a dubbing actor, you should be trying to produce the same sound as the situation, the same acoustics as the situation you're seeing on screen. That, in fact, when you're really dubbing well and really you really project yourself into what you're seeing on the screen, I lose consciousness of the studio. I'm totally fixed on what I'm looking at and trying to sound like what I'm seeing, what the situation is on screen. And for that reason, too, dubbing actors, the Spanish dubbers who do this every day, they're amazing. They walk into they've got the takes. They memorize their take like the first time through, second at most if it's like a monologue. And they watch the scene twice. They've already seen their visual cues for where they're coming in, where they're not, so on and so forth. So they see the scene like, they see the take like twice, have memorized the script, have noticed where they have to come in and out, whether they're close to the camera, far from the camera, and so on. And then they record it in like two goes. next take. And it's like, it's for me.
Nikki Garcia. Yeah. One take.
It's amazing. It's amazing when they do that stuff. So, you know, but now that's dubbing, however, is something that I think is going to change drastically with AI.
Well, hey, I will wrap up there. This has been phenomenal talking to you. I could actually just listen to you intently for hours and hours, but I won't. I'll give you some of your day back. Is there any way people can contact you if they want any advice on this stuff or anything they can do? Because you're not really big on social media, are you? You've really only got LinkedIn, and that's
I'm not. I should be bigger. I keep telling myself I have to take more photos, do more videos, put them up on Instagram, and I should. I sometimes put up stuff on Facebook, but that's basically just for friends so that they know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
I do occasionally do stuff on Instagram. I'm trying to be better and more disciplined about it. I have a bunch of stuff from the video game. Well, not a bunch of stuff, but I have some stuff from the video game that we just finished recording for Aeternum Game Studios. They're the people who did Aeterna Noctis. I don't know if you know that. That's another Metroid game from a little while ago. And this one,
Metroidvania, yeah.
I have a little trouble with the categories because they were explaining, no, well, you know, Aeterna Noctis is Metroid, but this new one, Eden Genesis, no, this is Metroidvania. And I said, okay, could you explain, not being a heavy-duty gamer myself, I have a little difficulty with the categories. But but I have some material, so I need to start putting that stuff up on Instagram. I do put stuff up on LinkedIn periodically, and people can contact me on LinkedIn for sure. You know, I don't know if I want to give... I'm not sure I want to give out my email or something.
No, don't.
I don't think that's a good idea.
I don't think that's a good idea either.
They can locate me via LinkedIn, Stephen Hughes.
Yeah.
In Madrid, Stephen with a PH, of course, which gives Spaniards fits. And then again, I'm also on Instagram. I've got I just set it up for a separate, you know, so keeping my personal account, but setting up a new professional one.
Well, yeah, but if you give me the professional one, I can link it in the video. That's no problem.
Oh, great. Okay.
Yeah.
And I can do the same thing with the LinkedIn address. Well, you've got that already. That's how we've been. That's how we've been playing phone tag or message tag, I guess, for so long.
For a long time.
This is really fun, man.
As I said, I was kind of before we started recording. I was a little intimidated about doing this, and I was thinking, what have I got to say, you know? But
you got a lot to say. You have a lot of knowledge, a lot of wisdom. So, I mean, I've been listening intently this whole time, so I very much appreciate it. I've learned a lot. I'm sure the audience will learn a lot as well. So,
great. Yeah. I hope so.
Yeah.
So.
And you know, I hope I have contributed to make their gameplay experience that much richer.
Yeah. You know? Indeed. All right. Well, that is the show, everyone. Make sure you share, like, and subscribe. And until next time, stay safe.